This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Russell, and today we have BFM's very own producer of videos here, Rahma Pauzi.
Hi, Cam.
Hi. And we have returning, after far too long, he's a once upon a time creative director in advertising, he's an actor, and his name is Vernon Adrian Among.
Thank you for having me again.
Oh, pleasure. And our three topics this week are topic number one, Elton John. Topic number two, racism. And finally, topic number three, influencers. Such short names, I can remember them this time. And so, Vernon.
Yes, sir.
Elton John.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk about Elton John because I feel that somehow there is a general misfit about what we know of Elton John compared to his life. And recently there was a movie that was released, Rocketman. And I did see the movie. And I liked it very much. But I was thinking about Elton John as this amazing global icon. He wouldn't be there if it wasn't for his lyricist, Bernie Taupin. Uh-huh. And I just thought that, you know, it does take more than just one person to make a huge, significant mark in the world. And Elton John is quite a significant mark in that we kind of like have followed his life from the time he came to public prominence until today, and he's still relevant in that he's still engaged in various things, such as producing his own biopic. Mm. And do you know that Candle in the Wind, the 1997 version of the song, which he did in tribute to Princess Diana, is the biggest selling single ever?
Yeah?
Ever, ever.
Really?
Yeah.
Until today?
Until today.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I did not know that. Well, okay.
So, yeah. So, the thing is, Bernie Taupin did write that song, the original version, with Elton John.
Hmm.
And the words of the song, the lyrics, are incredibly poetic and, you know, really honest. And, yeah, it calls out to you to understand the predicament of a young man completely taken over by Marilyn Monroe.
Hmm.
In this case, in the rewrite of the song, in tribute to Princess Diana.
Yeah, and Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones was most dismissive. He was saying, oh, Elton's still making money off dead blondes.
Oh, no. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Dude, you're shocked, aren't you? I thought it was actually very funny.
So that, sorry, I'm like not very familiar with Elton John, except the fact that I was familiar with his songs as a kid,
right,
not knowing that it belonged to Elton John.
Well, what did you imagine this Elton John thing was? Did you have any thought about him?
I imagined him to be like a little kid when I first heard it. I guess maybe because the lyrics are always very relatable. In the sense, like the Candle in the Wind, when you mentioned that. Yeah. I was like, I think maybe I was like 7 when I first heard it. I was not exposed to a lot of English music growing up. Most of my parents spoke Malay at home. But Elton John was like one of the songs that permeated our living room. And yeah. And when I first saw him, like, it's just like, it's a spectacle in a sense that he had like very eccentric.
He was a spectacle.
He was a spectacle.
Yeah.
Quite literally, he would wear very big spectacles. He's famous.
Yeah. To me, I would always remember him as someone who breaks that point of view, a 7-year-old, of how a man should dress himself.
Yeah,
up.
Actually, he's quite a barrier breaker in very many ways. I mean, like, he was one of the first stars to say he was bisexual, and then he came out later. He got married
to a woman.
To a woman, and then to a guy.
Yeah.
And now he's got kids. So as same-sex parents, they have, I think, 2 or 3 children. He was the first public figure to bring HIV/AIDS to the forefront. And he's very much involved in that. So in terms of like going against the grain and doing things the way he believes it should be done, like living his own life, incredible.
And yet, I don't want to seem mean here.
Right.
But
you're doing a Keith Richards thing.
Well, the thing is, like, you know, with Lennon McCartney, you know, they would write the music and they would write their own lyrics. And it always struck me, I don't dislike Elton John, but he's never really been the forefront of the things I love.
Okay.
But one of the things is like, but I mean, to be true greatness, You write, you write the music, mm-hmm. and you write your lyrics.
Yes, which comes back to the point of Bernie Taupin, right?
Yeah.
But you see, the thing about it is that somebody writes the lyrics, and he takes ownership of it, and comes up with the most amazing melodies. So I kind of like find that quite fascinating, because most of us kind of like have no idea. I mean, not say no idea, but forget that there was this other guy there who brings meaning to what would be actually, I won't say aimless melodies, but melodies, you know, like certain songs don't mean as much until you put lyrics into it.
Yeah, because the way that they did it, their greatest hits package was called Separate Rooms, mm-hmm. because they would write in separate rooms.
Right.
Bernie Taupin would write a bunch of words,
yep.
and then he would give that over to Elton John, who would just sit there and just put music to the words.
Right.
So it's not the other way around.
Yes, yes. I mean, when I discovered that in the movie, I was shocked. I thought that a lyricist would actually write to the music that has been created.
That's what I always
thought. Yeah, so when I realized that, I actually respected Elton John even more. I guess maybe it's because I kind of like went along that same route in advertising when I was a copywriter. I'd have to come up with lyrics for a jingle, and then I'd have to force feed it to a musical composer. And of course, you know, it blew me away when a melody would come back,
yeah.
and it's like completely different to what I imagined it, and it worked.
Yeah,
you know,
that is one of the mysterious moments. And Rahma, I'm sure you have this in your video work, because mm-hmm. I'm a filmmaker by training, and you would create a film and you'd cut it together, and then you'd stick a piece of music on top, and suddenly whatever it was you've shot, the most mundane thing,
it gives
it a different meaning, and it's like epic. It's like mm-hmm. oh, this is cinema. You know,
exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. So you are a fan.
Yes, I'm a fan. I'm not a huge fan.
Huge fan.
But I'm a fan. I sing all the songs in the karaoke.
And you enjoyed the movie?
I enjoyed the movie. I thought the movie was, much more honest and detailed than Bohemian Rhapsody.
See, what I respect the fact that Bohemian Rhapsody, which was executive produced by the surviving Queen members,
yep.
and this movie, executive producer Elton John.
Yes, correct.
I think it's really clever the way that these old rockers, whose library should be gathering dust and forgotten about,
that's true,
have found
that's
a way true. To reinvent yep. and sell themselves to mm-hmm. a new young audience, mm-hmm. and to create a story that resonates with young people. It's like, oh my God, this guy was a gay crusader from years mm-hmm. back, such a brave man. Yep, I want to be like that. And I think that's genius.
Yeah, and it's reappropriating your own creative self.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's really smart.
Mm.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad the movie was made, and I'm looking forward to it's going to be a trilogy, because the third one will be on guess who?
What is it?
Who?
David Bowie.
Oh my God. Oh no. My
you're kidding.
Well,
come on.
Somebody's got to do it, right?
I agree. Someone's got to do it, but I don't know how. I don't know how.
You don't know how?
And it's going to be one
who
of those.
Who do you think will play it? In fact, you should go for the audition.
Oh, no way. I think it'll have to be... Producer Ali, do we have another half an hour? No, better not. Let's not go down that road. Okay. Well, that's Elton John and the movie Rocket Man. And we're going to move on, though, to something completely different, mm-hmm. which is, topic number two, racism.
Ooh.
And this is inspired by...
Loaded.
Loaded. Inspired by recent events, by words spoken by an Indian national on Malaysia, which were... I thought to be very offensive and mm-hmm. racist. And in the age of Donald Trump, this thing, racism, is being thrown around globally now. And the insult, all the condemnation, you're racist, is thrown at people. And I'm thinking, one, just to investigate that, so that racism, I think that, well, certainly we three in this room, and I would imagine most of our listeners, kind of feel is a bad thing. And I just want to investigate, one, is it? Why is it?
Mm-hmm.
And also, how come being accused of being a racist, how come that stings? Because I feel that we here in Malaysia live in a country which is multiracial.
Yep.
And in America as well. Although a lot of people will call themselves just white,
mm-hmm.
But there are nonetheless... They came from Greece originally, the forebears from Greece, from Russia, from whatever. Yep. And there are black Americans, and there are Arab Americans, and there are what have you. And I think it's understood deep down that for the society to really work, mm-hmm. for the fabric to be held together,
yes.
to for it to function,
yep.
One cannot have racism in that you can't hate, you shouldn't be able to walk around being hate people, because otherwise the whole thing just falls apart.
Yeah, but the thing is, we also need to be aware and respect and even celebrate the other.
Mm.
So in that situation, I guess your question about is racism good or bad?
Mm.
Racism in the context of what it has come to mean is not good.
Mm.
Mm.
Racialization, mm. right, which mm. is another kind of word mm. with the root word being race, is good. In that, but it could also be bad if you racialize something.
And also racializing, I guess you can do that to yourself, can't you? You yeah, racialize yeah. yourself.
Like I say, I'm Sorani.
Yes, you certainly do.
Yeah. yeah. And people say, what race is that? And I say, you know, it goes beyond race.
Mm.
And that's where we should take it, beyond race.
Because it's impossible to be racist against you, isn't it?
Oh, totally impossible.
It's like a moving target.
Okay, I want to just pick up on an earlier note that you made when you said that when did it become like a negative connotation?
Hmm.
I also wanted to say that, weirdly, like I think about a couple years ago, when I was still in the States, when Trump just got elected, suddenly, and I think it's still a thing there now, that racism has turned into something that's positive, like, yes, I'm racist, so what? Mm-hmm. It's about an empowerment for people who've been acting racist since the past few decades, and suddenly they're like, oh, I'm sick of this. And I think that's what happened to, you know, this Indian national preacher when people try, you know, starting to say that you are dividing people, you are doing this, you're doing that. And he was like, yeah.
So he dug in his heels and he decided, yeah, okay, I'm going to use this against
yeah.
you.
So he's like, okay, so then so what? You know, then what are you going to do? So, but is that okay for you to kind of like so what a word?
Yeah,
like
well, that? Yeah. I mean, eventually, anybody who feels they have been shackled by this will want to throw off those shackles and claim it in a positive light. But I want to ask also something that was raised just recently, which is the countering mm-hmm. of, no, you're racist. So in Trump land, it's very popular now.
Yep.
It's no, the Democrats. Rahma, you help me out here. You know how it's used better than I do. You know, the ones who are calling me racist are actually the racist ones.
Yeah, the real racists are the ones who call other people racist. Yeah, that's what they're
because
saying.
The logic being, I don't recognize race. I'm just condemning people right. because they're, I don't know, lazy.
Yeah.
Whereas you're saying that I'm. I don't know why I can't even better, but they are using it a lot. Like, no, you're racist.
Right. Because you notice these differences.
Right. Whereas I'm above that.
I don't. Yeah. I'm colorblind, whatever that means.
Yeah. Yeah. I just hate everybody. But and then, so racism, if you go to certain countries, though, where everybody's the same.
Okay.
Right. Then being racist is not a problem. Because it's not going to dismantle the harmony of the community and the nation, because there are no others.
But what do you mean by everybody's the same? Like in a community where everybody's the same, like could you explain that?
If they self-identify as a particular ethnic group, right, and mm-hmm. The neighboring country is a different ethnic group.
Yep.
So there's this one little enclave of ethnic group X.
Yep.
And if they are racist about ethnic group Y, which is the neighboring country, it's not a problem.
Well, I guess it happens. People become racist when they feel threatened, when their comfort zones are basically intruded upon by people who are different from them and they have no understanding of what the other person means to them. Just the points. I mean, like, I went to study in Australia in 1980, I arrived in Australia.
Right.
Okay, yeah. And yes, call me uncle. And I arrived in, and I lived in a town called Rockingham in West Australia, which was basically a seaside town outside a city area. And I was actually the only Asian kid.
Mm.
Okay. But because I was different from everybody else, I was celebrated as the novelty.
Mm.
You know,
because you were the only one.
Yeah,
you were not a threat yet.
I was not a threat yet. Yes.
If there were a thousand,
like me, yeah,
if correct. There were 1,000 other Saranis,
yeah,
then it would have been a problem.
Because
I wouldn't have been wrong because you're wonderful people.
We make suji cake and invite everybody over. So it's all about identity politics. Only comes in when you are confronted by your own sense of self.
Yes.
You know, I just saw a video earlier before I came, and this lady described herself as a radical feminist, mm-hmm. and it made me wonder, why did she decide to label herself in such a kind of like extreme way, radical feminist? What kind of value does it bring to your position in identity politics to call yourself a radical, proudly?
Well, yeah, but then you're not just a wishy-washy run-of-the-mill feminist. You're actually out there on the streets fighting for it.
But what does that even mean? Okay.
Well, you're fighting for it. You're actively...
Active,
you're not
yeah,
a passive.
I guess. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's your job.
As perhaps, it maybe, yeah. I mean, it's a position that they take up and... You're proud of it, and like so there are gradations of like even identities within one identity. Are there gradations?
Absolutely,
like,
it always breaks down. What, in the end.
So you're a Chilup Malay,
mm-hmm.
and Ramla is a
Rama.
Rama.
Full on Malay.
Yeah, kinda, I guess.
Kinda. So how do you relate to each other?
Well, for a start, it's me and Rama against you.
Yeah. But I've got a bit of. Malayu DNA somewhere floating around.
Oh, then okay,
around.
So you're just somewhere in the spectrum. I guess we belong together then.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's nice. We are right. On a spectrum.
But we'll conclude this, though. But I just want to say, I think also that we all do want to be and enjoy being, knowing that we are part of something bigger than just ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So our clan, to advertise our clan membership is good. I mean, we enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
And that would by necessity sometimes require that there be another clan, an other clan.
Yeah.
And that we are not like them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So how do you deal with that? Is that what you're saying? Like within Malaysia, for instance, right? So there are the different racial communities, the different races, okay? When does it get nasty? Of course, when we challenge each other to...
I feel it gets nasty when we decline to accept the clan Malaysian.
Correct, yeah.
I think it gets nasty when it comes to a point where you are threatening other people's Periuk Nasi or like, you know, your economic well-being.
Imposition.
When you point out... something to do with economic access, resources, mm-hmm. and also power, I would say, then, yeah, I don't think it's about you not recognizing, oh, you can be better than that. I think it's like the moment someone's hand is on top of my, you know, my rice pot, then I'll be like, nope.
Mm. Right.
Then I'm going to recognize you as such.
Yeah. You are threatening my safety, my security.
To me, it boils down to economy.
Good Marxist analysis there.
You know, recently our Prime Minister mentioned that a particular association was racist.
Hmm.
And somebody came back with an essay. I could mention names, but I won't. Defending the organization. And I went through the points of why this person said that the association was not racist. Because they did this, they did this, they did this. And then I looked through the points and I realized something. Yes, the points... were valid and perhaps true, but those positions were taken because the association had a stake in those positions. Mm. So it's when you take a stand and you have no stake in it, like a white athlete in America going on bended knee, right, when the anthem is played, and the bended knee gesture is about bringing attention to Black Lives Matter and, you know, the discrimination that Black Americans feel, you know? So, like, when a white athlete does that, it's totally genuine, you know? And you feel, okay, this person is not anti-Black or anti-African American.
All right.
You know? He has taken on the suffering...
The journey.
The discrimination, the journey of the other. And that's when I feel we stop becoming racist. So how many of us can actually claim to do that when we have defended or stood up for, you know, another yeah. who's not of your kind?
The others, right.
Yeah, okay. I can't answer that question. I have no idea. so we've got to move on, though. And I hope we've sorted that one out. And I think Malaysia is a better place now. But in a moment, we're going to be talking about influencers here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Vernon Adrian Among, and Rahma Pauzi. And now, Rahma, influencers.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not sure if you have came across this video, but I think over the past week, there's this viral video that probably has made it to your social media platform mm-hmm. of this one lady who is an influencer, Aisha Malik, Pakistani-American, mm-hmm. Questioning Priyanka Chopra, the Bollywood and now Hollywood actress at the beauty conference, BeautyCon in LA. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, Priyanka was there just talking about beauty.
You're familiar with that, I'm sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Before, she was fired with a question from Aisha, who's this influencer, yeah. who, rise and then started talking about, hey, I was kind of hurt hearing you talk about humanity because as your neighbor, a Pakistani, I know you're a bit of a hypocrite. That's what Aisha was saying. And then she went on saying that, if I'm not mistaken, I think in the past few months, she basically said that Priyanka tweeted Jai Hind. It's like, long live India, something like that.
Victory, actually, victory.
Yeah, right. Yeah. With the hashtag Indian Armed Forces. Mm. And I think at that time was when I think the Indian Army was attacking.
They were shooting jets down and flying over.
Right. Yeah. So it got me thinking, right? So basically she was saying that you are UN Peace Ambassador, and then the fact that you tweeted that made me feel like you're not living up to whatever that you're saying, you know? Like you were in Rohingya trying to just meet this kid, so whatever. What does that even mean? Okay, so that's one situation. But and also got me thinking about another situation. So I guess I have to give a little bit more context because it's a bit more fun. Have you heard of Imam Muda and Pencetus Ummah?
Nope.
This is funny. Okay, so it's like a reality TV show, but to basically find your next ustad or next imam. So this is imam. I don't remember where it was broadcast because I didn't follow this, but I just really love the controversy and all the drama that came after that. Oh my God, I love it. Anyway, so so there have been like a few people that came out of this reality show. So imagine it as Academy Fantasia or American Idol.
And they become influencers.
Yeah. But whatever that is, they were just basically, in my opinion, was just like trained as an orator. You know, you're just good at just speaking.
Right.
And these are like 23, 24 years old who just graduated from, some university, whatever. And probably this is the only, life they've been fed with. One day you got to be like lecturer. One day you got to be preacher, whatever.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily that they have the knowledge or the depth in nuance of their worldview. They just know how to speak.
So what are they, what kind of brands are they representing?
Or? They don't have any brands or whatever right now. Yeah. But
they are becoming influencers
in
their own right.
Yes, right. Exactly. Okay, an IKEA endorsed, influencers or something like that. So what's the drama here is that one of them, I think a couple months ago, there's like a controversy saying that he said after he became popular, he immediately divorced his wife.
Oh,
he was just married for like a few months and then she was pregnant because he suddenly fell in love with someone on Instagram.
This is like Dallas.
Exactly. And so that's like from Pencetus Ummah, I think. And if I'm not mistaken, there's another person. I'm not sure whether or not it's from Pencetus Ummah or from Imam Muda. So this was like a bit of research that I did before decided to do this. And I was surprised that I found something else. Someone else got caught in controversy of, sending nude selfies to people. I know, right? So what I'm saying is that, so people started blaming them. Oh my God, you're supposed to be like self-righteous, supposed to be this and that. But you're not that. But I would like to argue, and this is like where I would like to open this up to you both a little bit. I think it all boils down to just our dissatisfaction and our inability to trust traditional media or traditional institutions to lay out messages to us anymore. We cannot relate to that anymore. So we always have to feel like as if we could relate to Priyanka Chopra. We could relate to PU something. We could relate to this Imam Muda. And maybe to begin with, these people don't know anything. You know what I mean? Yeah, if you want to become a celebrity, you have to do this. It's It's like, have you checked that box where you become a humanitarian ambassador?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. Sure.
Yes, well, yeah. So what do you guys think?
Well, Vernon, you're an advertising man.
Well, okay. The point whether we are beginning to mistrust like mainstream media and therefore beginning to trust these personalities more than mainstream media. Media is using these personalities as a manner in which to get into your head. Okay, so it's the work of media who's doing it. And that whole idea of personalities representing something, when I was in advertising, you know, we'd look for well-known personalities to become ambassadors of the brands, and we try to look for personalities that seem to be in aligned with the brand characters that we want to bring forth. And I guess what's happening here is that they are not. What exactly are the brand characteristics that we are assuming these people represent? With regards to this religious characters, right? Of course, we have an idea of what kind of values, right, they hold and what they represent, how they live their lives. But in this case, there's no brand manager checking them out. They've just become famous on their own, on the backs of their own visibility on popular TV.
Because they just did something that just happened to work.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
People just sort of like... Right. Just felt, but also whatever it was that people saw,
yes,
they then want that person to remain that.
Exactly.
And it's a bit vague what it is that they want. So they it's a feeling thing, and they become very upset if people escape from that that zone.
I mean, the screen is a very intimate medium.
I suppose. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So because you're holding your iPad in your living room. You're thinking that person is there with you. I mean, like, I used to host a TV show 5,000 years ago. Mm. And till this day...
We are old.
Till this day, people kind of... I'm not that it was a great show, but I think there was a level of intimacy that got me into their minds that, you know, like, as though they know me, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah. So the intimacy level between...
It's gone up by a factor of 1,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So our impressions of these people run deeper, and it has a lot to do with our own lived experiences.
Mm. But also, I didn't realize that with the particular Priyanka Chopra situation, that the woman who was accusing her, as it were,
was also an influencer.
I didn't realize that.
Yes, she was an influencer.
So this is another thing that the canny influencer, the canny social media user does, is to find somebody... something more famous.
Yeah. And then ride on that.
Use that as a vehicle to expand their fame.
Tumpang glamour.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because I try and do that all the time.
That's right. Because she was at BeautyCon, for goodness sakes. And then suddenly, the next thing you know, it's about how Priyanka Chopra wants to start a nuclear war.
Right.
And this woman, I didn't catch her name.
Aisha Malik
is...
And that's an interesting point, because that's what brands try to do. Yeah. They try to tumpang glamour on those personalities, you know.
Yeah, I mean, bear in mind, like, it's not like, I don't think the questions that she asked were not valid, nor, I think it was, okay, yeah, it is like conflicting, and I understand where she comes from. I'm just saying that we're putting too much faith and value to this ambassador thing, that we want to punish these influencers the moment, like you said, they don't align with our values anymore. Mm. But to begin with, do they even hold those values?
Well, yeah, because, you know? I think that in this particular case with Priyanka Chopra, is that you said that, you know, we want them to adhere to this value system and all that kind of thing. I don't think anybody does in this particular case, because UNICEF chose her. UNICEF is old fuddy-duddy multinational corporation without... It's real proper
thing. And UNICEF is the brand that you mentioned earlier.
And they chose Priyanka Chopra, who's not really a woman who really kind of resonates, you know? It's like a recognized face.
I felt the same way.
Does she have kids?
No, she doesn't. She just got married.
Okay. Just got married to this Jonah fellow, which has actually made her a little bit more, has helped humanize her character. Mm-hmm. But she's not like really set the world on fire.
Yeah.
So I don't
she's
think
she's a celebrity.
Oh, yeah, celebrity. She's famous for being famous.
Yeah.
And so it's not really the end of her brand, I think. What was upsetting to people, I think, was that she was a bit rude in her response.
Yeah,
that's and that true. That yeah. does not align with her brand because she's so glamorous and graceful. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a surprise then that she was a bit kind of like, just sit down and shut up.
But also, could it have been misinterpreted what she posted? Maybe she wanted for the soldiers to be there to enforce peace.
Because
of positions that you take with regards to the Kashmir-India situation, you know, what you say, I can misread and think that you're on the other side.
Because, I don't speak Hindi, but mm-hmm. Jai Hind is like victory to India or something, mm-hmm. which I think is probably slips off the tongue like Malaysia Ole. But, you know, she is Indian. Her market is India. Her family are Indian. She makes her living from India. She doesn't make it from Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, she's going to say, go India.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm quite interested in the other case that you were talking about, where these young people go into this reality TV show, which is religious in its format, and so you assume that these people would be moral, upstanding,
right.
Yeah.
Righteous,
yeah. You know, and they are not.
Yeah. And then in moments of their social media lapses, little bits come out that, like, you know, and then we judge them, you know, and
we like, we dislike, yeah, we write a comment, yeah. Right, we're involved.
And we get really kind of like
we feel betrayed and unnecessarily, I would like to say, yeah. You know, yeah. it's like, so I mean, just quickly, it was baffling to me because Oprah kind of like, I don't know, hinted that she wanted to run for presidency.
Yes, correct.
You know, a couple months ago, right?
Yeah.
And then people were like, oh my God, Oprah. But I'm like, Oprah is good at being Oprah. Like, how are you? You know,
she's the best in the business.
Yeah. How's that different from like, yay, Trump, like running for presidency, like for people who love Trump, you know, in The Apprentice.
How's that difference?
Yeah.
Yeah. How's interesting. That,
yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, or like Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. We must. Move on. We must move on. Clearly, we could
go on.
Celebrities. You were dismissing celebrities, but yet we can talk for hours.
I know. I'm so invested to them. Yeah. I told you.
Okay. Yeah, they're symbolic. They're cultural symbols.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of like.
Okay. You know, so, we're gonna move on. We're gonna move on to the last part of the show. Recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest. And Vernon goes first.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. I want to recommend that we make laksa our national dish.
Is there such a thing as a national dish?
Well, a lot of people have said recently, in recent times, that nasi lemak should be our national dish.
Oh, I saw this poll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And laksa, I really
what,
feel...
Laksa what?
Just whatever. Laksa.
Just laksa in general?
Yeah, laksa in general. We need to claim it quickly. Because, you know, I'm traveling around the world. I've realized that laksa is beginning to kind of like, you know, squirrel its way into various... Yeah, well, global cities.
Into gentrified neighborhoods, well,
like,
yes.
Yeah.
What have you been talking about? Like Laksa Brussels?
Well, no. Yeah. Yeah.
I think I know. Yeah, you're right. And they just, the base is the same. And they said, I saw this Laksa Shanghai, Laksa Brooklyn. Laksa, what is that? I'm not kidding. Well, I've seen this.
Basically, it's where laksa is being made.
Uh-huh.
But the way of making laksa is actually multiracial. I mean, it's noodles from China, okay? Uh-huh. Spices from India or Nusantara, mm-hmm. right? And it could be anything you want in there. Fish or meat or vegetables.
It's mostly fish broth, right?
Not necessarily. Like, not necessarily. But there is such a combination of ingredients that it represents Malaysia in all its diversity and beauty.
So you're saying we should go out and copyright it and
exactly
and police it. So when we go to Brooklyn and we see a copyright, laksa, we shut it down.
Yes,
it's beginning to be like Pokeball. You know when they have like this different correct. Name for Pokeball. Yeah. That's what I was trying to say.
No, I think if that's the case, then I think that'd be great.
People just need to be educated a little bit that it's Malaysian.
Yeah,
no, they don't.
They say it's Hawaiian, right?
Yeah.
And actually, like, you wonder, like, okay, it's Japanese?
Exactly. Right? People started to confuse that.
The worst thing in the world would be if you're sitting down to have your laksa Iowa, right? In Iowa City, suddenly this mad Serrani fella bursts down the door and says, that's Malaysian.
No,
that's not going to be good for us.
I wouldn't burst through the door. I'd come in with a kompang troop.
I'd say, by the way, okay, but you got a lot of work to do.
Kompang.
Yeah.
You're going to be a busy man. Okay, so that's I don't know what that is. Copyright laksa. So my recommendation is, it's a strange one, this. You know, I don't know if you people have heard of a thing called YouTube. It's quite popular.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Okay.
Sounds familiar.
Right. So, you know, YouTube says, you know, if you like this, you'll like this. It gives you these recommendations. Mm-hmm. I think it's given up on me because I seem to have watched absolutely nothing different. So it's like, what about this? Try this. Come on. It's like, nope, don't do that. So I've discovered one of the things that I look at the most is a very strange thing, which is I am really into trying to find out as much as possible about the bass lines of Paul McCartney in the Beatles.
What?
Yes. Now, hear me out. Because Paul McCartney, great songwriter, but is also, in my mind, the greatest bass player. Because the bass, which should be like just boom, 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 you know, sort of giving a kind of a rhythm or something. Yeah. What Paul McCartney does is, because he's a songwriter, even on someone else's song, he cannot help but create another melody, a tune. And it becomes a counter tune to the main tune. Yep. And it complements it. And then he changes it as it goes along. So I love listening to how a songwriter who's given a job, and not sort of a boring job in the recording session, of just go play the bass ball, cannot help but tell different stories in his bass lines.
Right, yeah.
And so I'm very intrigued by that. And nowadays with YouTube, people have videos where they just play the bass lines. You can just see his fingers. You can just... And I just find it absolutely compelling. So my recommendation is either go check out the bass lines of Paul McCartney or watch...
I intend to do that now.
Or watch the... There are all these videos where you will get a musician from a particular song and they will just focus on that particular instrument.
Yeah.
And it just tells you a different story of how that song actually operates and the levels that it operates on.
I don't know whether it's on the line, the same track of thought, but like mashups I find very interesting.
It's a completely different line of thought.
Different, isn't it? Yeah, completely. Okay, sorry. Yeah. I'll shut up now.
Yes.
But Ali Johan is the music person. Yeah, he's nodding his head, so I've got him on my side.
Okay. So, Rahma, what's yours?
Okay, so this is a little bit odd. I just thought about it this morning, although I have trying to attempt it since the past 2 weeks, trying to cat detox from Instagram.
That's very specific.
Very specific. Because I have two cats, and this is probably just only part of me because I'm very eccentric sometimes. I'm beginning to like not entertain my real cats because I was watching cats.
You're living in Instagram, is it?
Yeah.
You're in the IG world.
And I have two cats.
And just sitting there.
And I just don't like play with them as much.
Oh.
And I think because I was just like, oh my God, I hate like, you know, coming to work. I've been like going back home like late. So 3 weeks ago, I was like full on cat mode. Like usually on my Discover on Instagram, there's like some like workout videos and a lot of food videos and some like makeup tutorial. Okay, so you know what I'm looking at. And some of the cats. So I'm just like, okay, why hasn't this cat feed like been showing up? So I've been like looking at cats and I get like more and more and more and more recommendation and I got addicted.
Oh yeah?
And I noticed that, so my sister actually last week told me that, have you noticed that you haven't been playing with Kuching and Paddy, two of my cats?
Your cat is called Kuching.
They did in the corner. They haven't been fed in 2 weeks.
and they're just like, you should play with them. I'm like, yeah, I play. And then I was just thinking, no, I haven't. So I don't know. Like,
this is modern. This is a modern problem.
Yeah, so I'm just like, that's true. So I was just wondering if it applies to, you know, same to people. And the last time I actually, you know, was intensely looking at cat videos before bed for like about 45 minutes was like, I don't know, maybe like 7 years ago before I had a cat. So
you're bored of your cats. You might be bored of your cat because you've just simply called it Kuching. You really should try it a little harder. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
so that's it.
Rahma, that is the saddest story I've heard since the story you told about how your father couldn't watch the World Cup because he didn't have a TV. That's just a sad household. Okay. Well, good luck with that, Rahma.
Okay.
So get a detox from cat videos.
Yeah, basically it's a challenge. Can you guys actually do that? Yeah, so I don't know. If you guys could, let me know.
Well, you have to come back and tell us how it's gone.
I'll try.
Yeah, well, good luck with that one, because your cats deserve some love.
Yeah.
I just got a new cat, and I adore it, so yeah.
Okay. Stay away from Instagram.
Yeah, well, clearly. So that brings us to the end of this week's show. Cautionary tale there from Rahma. And only remains for me to thank Rahma Pazi.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And Vernon Adrian Amon.
Yeah, thank you again for having me.
Yep, pleasure. And myself, Cam Raslan. And I would say check out our Instagram account, but we don't have one. And So thank you very much. We're going to play out with a song. We're going to play out with a Elton John song. Yeah. Which one would you like to play out with?
Song for Guy, where he composed this piece without any help from Bernie Taupin.
And it's about a young boy who was found murdered.
Mm-hmm. Who works for the studio, I think, where the... Yeah. I don't think he was murdered. He died in an accident.
Oh, he did die in an accident. Sorry, died in an accident. And then Elton John.
So Elton John wrote a song called A Song for Guy.
And it's very nice. Okay, yes. So that's Elton John's Song for Guy playing us out from A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.